In early January of 2026, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced changes to the childhood and immunization schedules, reducing the number of vaccines recommended for children. This change led to the U.S. being an outlier in terms of required vaccines for children. One reason that people express concern about vaccines is that they fear adverse reactions to the vaccines. It may be a surprise to many that there is a comprehensive system in place to monitor adverse outcomes for vaccines. In the second part of our conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Morris, we will explore how vaccine safety is studied. While safety is a story of accumulation of evidence across different studies and systems, we also will consider how cherry-picking individual studies can lead to claims that mislead and misinform about vaccine safety. I'm John Baylor. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association, as well as Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. I'm joined in the studio by my colleague, Rosemary Pennington, chair of the Department of Media Journalism and Film. Our guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Morris. Morris is the George S. Pepper Professor of Public Health and Preventative Medicine and Director, the Biostatistics Division, Department of Biostatistics, Epidemiology, and Informatics at the Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. He also has been actively involved in scientific communication efforts on social media and with various media outlets. He's a distinguished research fellow at the Annenberg Center for Public Policy. Jeff, it's a delight to continue our conversation about vaccine safety with you today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
In your recent report for the Annenberg Public Policy Center, you provided a comprehensive review of the U.S. vaccine safety monitoring system. Can you start by giving us a quick overview of the separate components before we dig into each component in more detail?
Sure, yes. One thing is, vaccine safety monitoring is very challenging, and the system is complex, like I said, with many components involved. So first, there are pre-licensure clinical trials that are done, and these will establish basic efficacy and safety endpoints, as well as immunogenicity endpoints. But they are also have some limitations as to what they can detect in terms of more rare events. So that's the reason why after approval, post-approval safety monitoring is required and why we have the multi-component system to do that. So one of the components is a passive reporting system called VAERS, where individuals or doctors can report events that occur after vaccination. And those are recorded and kept in the database. And so that's called passive safety monitoring because individuals just voluntarily report and you're not sure who all is reporting. Then there's also active safety monitoring systems that are used then to follow up on signals that might have been found in the passive monitoring system. And so those limitations of the pre-licensure clinical trials are the reason why we have required post-approval safety monitoring system that is done. And so there are different components of that monitoring system. And the two major components are a passive monitoring system and an active monitoring system. So the passive monitoring system involves individuals and doctors reporting events that occur after vaccination that get accrued and investigated to see if there's any that appear to be reported more than you would expect and might be safety signals. Then the active reporting systems are then used to follow up on these safety signals. And these typically involve medical record systems where they go in and check whether these events are in fact occurring more often after vaccination than in control groups. And that includes for the CDC, the Vaccine Safety Data Link, and the FDA, the PRISM system. And then there's also a number of other government medical records that can be used to validate those signals in active reporting. And then there's kind of a third piece, the Clinical Immunization Safety Assessment Project. And this is more focused on providing clinical consultation and in-depth case investigation for individual patients, because the active and passive monitoring systems are pretty much epidemiological systems to to try and look for patterns in the population. But another important component is to dig deeply into individual clinical cases, which can sometimes reveal its own insights or hypotheses.
Jeff, I know that for some folks who are concerned about vaccines, the clinical trial process seems to be confusing for them or something they don't quite understand. Could you walk, before we start talking about the sort of post-market monitoring, could you talk us through like what the clinical trial process is like for vaccines?
Yes. So typically, it really depends on context exactly what the details of the trials are. But typically for a vaccine to be initially approved, there need to be randomized controlled trials demonstrating efficacy and a basic degree of safety. And these, if this is a vaccine that is for a new disease where there's none that exists, they'll many times use a placebo control. But if there's an existing vaccine that's being used already, they'll use the existing vaccine as a control group. And they look at efficacy endpoints, basic safety endpoints, but also immunogenicity endpoints. And when it's a vaccine that has been studied in the past, and there's, for example, a reformulation, like maybe the flu vaccines that get updated every year, they may just look at a smaller trial to look at immunogenicity and just make sure that it's generating the immune response they expect.
And, you know, one thing that you mentioned in your description of these clinical trials and the shortcomings is that they just can't be big enough to detect rare adverse outcomes, that they just don't have that kind of sensitivity. It's impossible, even with tens of thousands of participants.
That's right. Yeah. And I get into that a little bit in the white paper that I wrote for Annenberg, where looking at the phase 3 trials for the COVID vaccines, they were double-blind placebo-controlled trials, and they had about 20,000 per arm, which would be considered a large study. But I did calculations and showed there that basically to find a statistically significant effect for an adverse event, it would have to be 1 in 1,000 or more with that design. So especially when we're talking about vaccines that are given to a healthy population and the whole population, there's many adverse events that we're concerned about that are a lot more rare than 1 in 1,000, but we're just not going to have the statistical power. Like the COVID vaccines, the overall myocarditis effect, which was one of the key risks of the mRNA vaccines, were somewhere around 1 in 50,000 to 1 in 100,000 in the population. And even in the highest risk narrow subgroup, that with the benefit of hindsight, we see that males given second dose, late teens, early 20s, it might have been as high as like 1 in 3,000 to 1 in 8,000. But even so, those would have never been detected in the clinical trial. So that's why we need the post-approval safety monitoring systems to look at rare events like that, as well as events that are long delayed or under other conditions, like, for example, cumulative dose effects of multiple vaccines.
So you mentioned one of those tests is, or one of those ways of testing for safety efficacy is VAERS. Could you walk us through what that is and maybe what some of the pros and cons of that are?
Yes. The Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System is a passive reporting system where individuals or their family or their healthcare providers can simply update or upload information into VAERS that they had an event that occurred after vaccination. So this is not verified. Anyone can upload anything, and there's no knowledge of causation, just simply that the event occurred and that someone reported it. But one of the strengths of the system is that it's an open system. Anyone can report to it, and any type of event could be reported. So there could be some things that are not anticipated, and for example, not tracked in the trial, but are real risks. So for example, the myocarditis, I'm not sure that they were even specifically concerned about that before the trial, but it was seen in VAERS and other similar systems that this was clearly being reported way more than you would think and allowed detection. So the scope of it and the openness of it allows for potential early detection even of rare events. And another aspect that I think is mostly really beneficial is the transparency of it, that the database is open to the public, so anyone can query it and look at it. But of course, when people don't understand the data, this can end up feeding a lot of misunderstandings and misinformation, which we've really seen during the pandemic. So that's sort of the downside of it. But one thing I'll mention about VAERS, though, is so it's a very good system, but it has limitations. Like, two key limitations are, first of all, it's passive reporting. So you don't know how many people who had the event reported it. So there's a reporting bias, and it's of unknown magnitude, and it's clear that the magnitude varies from event to event, severity, timing. So it's difficult to know what you're not seeing. So for this reason, you can't really use it as a reliable estimate of incidence in the population. But the other limitation that's maybe even more major is that you have no control group. And because any event is going to occur at a certain frequency in the population, even deaths, heart attacks, strokes, whatever, these are going to occur with some level of incidence after vaccination, even if the vaccine had absolutely nothing to do with it. And so without a control group, it's really challenging to assess, is this number of reports high enough to make me confident that this is in fact a safety signal and that we're not just seeing events that would have occurred anyway? And because you don't have a control group, it's difficult to do that from VAERS alone. And for this reason, VAERS is mainly a hypothesis generation system. It's a way of coming up with safety signals that are potential hypotheses of harm, but these signals need to be validated in other more rigorous studies to really figure out whether these are occurring more often than expected after vaccination.
I thought it was interesting that in the report that you generated, that some of the outcomes after vaccination that were reported included things like sunburn and toothache,
yeah,
and x-rays of limbs and abnormal dreams, things that there's no connection to this. And you know, you mentioned that the system is passive in the sense that people have to, they sort of engage at their own will in terms of doing this. But it's also open for anyone to explore it, isn't it? It can be that others can access this information and analyze it. That's
exactly right. Yes, it's an open system. You can download it and analyze it yourself. And some people have made other dashboards to make accessing it even more streamlined.
That seems like it really leaves itself open to some really great opportunities for misuse, especially if it's used kind of naively and not as a hypothesis generator, but in terms of confirming what someone might believe about the possible, the risks associated with vaccines.
No, absolutely. And I think the transparency is really critical, but the downside is that there's no quality control on what people do when they analyze it. And in our world of social media, people will put claims out that are not assessed by scientists, and they go viral and they confirm other people's beliefs. And so that drives a lot of misinformation. And VAERS, I think, is the largest source of that. And I think the biggest problem is that people don't understand the concept of background event rate, that bad things happen all the time. And just because you got a vaccine doesn't mean that vaccine is going to prevent any bad medical event from ever occurring in your life. And so they look at the counts, and first of all, they will tend to think, oh, these were all caused by vaccines. But then further from that, they say, we know that not all are reported. And so then they'll inflate it by an assumed underreporting factor and say it's even higher. And one common choice is one grant report that suggested overall 1% of events are reported. And people take that to mean that the real number of events for every event is 100 times higher. So some people will actually take the number of reported events, multiply it by 100, and say this is the number of vaccine-caused events, which is, yeah, entirely blown out of proportion. And actually, there's a famous plot that's getting forwarded around right now that says measles vaccines kills more people than measles. And I've seen this like dozens and dozens of times forwarded by, you know, big time people that are followed by a lot. And what they did is they counted, they looked over the history of all deaths that were reported after a measles vaccine and called those measles deaths. And then they counted measles deaths that actually occurred. And of course, since we have well over 95% of the population vaccinated, measles really doesn't spread much. And even though if it spread like COVID, we would see that measles actually kills quite a bit, like relative to many other diseases, but there's just not much incident. And so that gets forwarded around, but their measles caused deaths is simply a count of VAERS reports.
So how does V-safe differ from VAERS?
Yeah, so V-safe is interesting because it's kind of a new thing they did during the pandemic, and I'm hoping they're going to continue to build on it. It's also a reporting system, but with V-safe, when people got their initial COVID vaccine, they could sign up for this system, and the system prompts you and asks you if you had any of these events or allows you to kind of have an open field response if you experience something else. And so in that way, you can, to some degree, estimate incidence because you know how many people signed up for the system. Now, you don't know how many people are paying attention to the request and are replying, so you still have that survey issue, but you at least know the population you surveyed. And so when it was used during the pandemic, it really was limited to only certain endpoints. So I don't think it was tremendously useful for more serious events, but it was really good in characterizing the short-term events after vaccination and how many people missed work and things like that. But I think that it has the potential to be an important component because of that element of, you know, what the denominator is of who signed up. And in principle, you could characterize the demographics. So you might be able to adjust for bias in the subset that agree versus the people in the population that don't agree.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Jeff Morris about vaccine safety. Jeff, with all of these systems in place, how can there be such a strong assertion that vaccines are unsafe and are linked to diseases like autism or other serious effects?
Well, and if you listen to the people making those arguments, there's a few reasons. One is that they say that safety has not been studied, and so they make people think there's no evidence that they're safe. And then second, they'll point to specific papers where they had results that suggested some type of connection between these events and vaccines without acknowledging that those are cherry picked, that they may be ignoring better studies, that those studies they're citing might have severe flaws that make their conclusions not trustworthy. And so in terms of the tactics that are used, I think that's sort of how the argument is made. And going back to sort of the first point of saying that vaccine safety is not studied, this argument is made in a very carefully worded, nicely lawyered wording that none of the current vaccines regularly given to children were themselves tested in placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trials. And so then they imply that because of that, we don't really know anything about the safety. And the implication is that they don't study it against placebo, because if they did, they would see just how horrendously dangerous the vaccines are. So it sort of feeds into the conspiratorial mindset. And that's one thing that I think this argument is effective, because if you emphasize the things we don't know, where there's less information, you can sort of tie that into nefarious motives to suppress information. And then you can insert your own claims and then challenge the other side to say, well, you can't disprove. It's never been disproven that vaccines cause autism. And since it hasn't been studied adequately, therefore, this is a reasonable assertion.
This, as you were talking about this, it made me think of this term that you shared with us, the Nirvana fallacy, when it comes to discussing vaccine and vaccine studies. Could you talk us through what that is? Because it does feel related to what you've just been discussing.
Yeah, I think it is related to that, to say there is no safety studies. And the Nirvana fallacy is a fallacy where people make an argument that because something is imperfect, therefore it's worthless. And so some people will make that argument with, say, COVID vaccines. Oh, well, the vaccines didn't stop transmission, therefore they didn't work. So that's an example of Nirvana fallacy, even though it's clear that the vaccines greatly reduce the risk of infection and all these severe outcomes, reduce transmission, but because it didn't completely stop it, therefore it failed, therefore it's worthless. So that's like one example. But I think where it's used in this context a little bit is in asserting that if a vaccine hasn't been studied with a placebo-controlled randomized trial, then therefore we don't know about the safety. And many times, the people that are promoting this argument will go further, and they will insist that what needs to be done is long-term placebo-controlled studies that are long enough to see things like autism and ADHD emerge, which might be 5, 7 years down the road. And they also argue that we don't know how the combinations of vaccines work together to cause these things, somehow implying that the placebo-controlled randomized trial should be looking at all possible combinations and interactions and all of those things. So all those things are implied, but then the argument is because we don't have that perfect study that would give us causal evidence on every question we have, therefore we haven't studied safety. And then the other side of that, the observational piece that is commonly mentioned by people making this argument is we don't have pure vaccinated versus unvaccinated observational studies. These would tell us everything. And because we don't have that, then we don't have information on safety. So then by doing that, they're ignoring the entire evidence base and literature on vaccine safety, of which there's actually a very large literature and a long history. And so that's kind of where the Nirvana fallacy comes in, is trying to get people not to look at the degree of evidence, not making a case for your assertion that it's unsafe, but simply setting up an impossible standard of the ideal studies that would need to be done to study safety. And because they haven't been done, therefore safety hasn't been demonstrated.
Gosh, I'm trying to think if I've ever seen a perfect study in any context with, and that, or any study that didn't have some kind of shortcoming that couldn't be highlighted as an opportunity for potential improvement or strengthening of a study. I mean, perhaps some of this is just tying to the idea that there is no such thing as this single study that's going to answer all questions. That's what I find really compelling about having a system of safety monitoring that spans the lifespan of from initial vaccine development to kind of this, once it's out in use and tracking it with the passive systems and then the electronic records through the active systems and then the case series. That seems like it's comprehensive. How do you kind of help people understand that, don't put your bet on just a single individual study that's been conducted?
Yeah, I mean that was really the main theme of the white paper I wrote and why I wrote it, because I feel like the public like really not necessarily understands VAERS. They're aware of VAERS. Some people understand it, but I think many people don't see how these different elements are supposed to complement each other and work together. And I think you're exactly right that even a very well-designed placebo-controlled clinical trial has limitations and can't tell you everything, so you have to supplement that. And each of these components tells you something different. So what I'll often say on social media, kind of as a mantra, is that what I think we all should be doing and what I try to do in my own just sort of investigation is that we need to critically assess all of the available evidence across all of these different types of studies, using scientific principles to help us draw information, draw conclusions and uncertainties from these, in order to figure out if there's things that we can establish as clearly true, are there claims we can establish are clearly false, And then what are the things where we have a significant level of uncertainty, and where is that gap? And hopefully that can get publicized so that studies can be done to fill in those gaps, to accrue that knowledge. But I think that the key is that it's only in aggregate can we really get the full picture. And cherry picking one study or even one part of the system while ignoring the rest gets in the way of that process of having an objective assessment and a complete picture.
Jeff, you know, journalists, I think, often get caught up in this trap of reporting on studies as they come out. And so sort of often are reporting on one-shot studies. And then two, I think, can, and I speak as someone who did science and medical reporting, so I'm not sort of blasting journalists, but can also have a struggle like communicating uncertainty, right? Like statistically, we all know what uncertainty is, but communicating that to an audience can be really hard as a journalist. And I do think there's a role journalists have played in helping spread bad information about vaccines by giving certain people platforms they shouldn't have. And I wonder what advice you would have for journalists who are trying to cover this well and cover this ethically about how they should approach reporting on vaccine safety and vaccine monitoring.
Yeah, and one thing I want to say is that, like, before the pandemic, I never really interacted a lot with the media. And since, I've done it a whole lot, especially scientific media. And the first thing I want to say is that I'm extremely impressed with so much of, like, the scientific media members that I talk to. Like, I kind of had a similar view as a lot of the public, skeptical towards the media, all that kind of stuff, trying to, you know, be sensationalistic or whatever, get clicks, and but without working with them. But as I worked with them, almost every time, I feel like they really want to understand these things. They really want to convey them clearly. So I think that's one thing that we should, you know, beating up the media, I don't think is helpful. And I kind of don't think it's fair because they're trying to convey things. And so I think we should partner with them. Like, our scientific community and our statistical community has a major role to play, because I think a lot of the misunderstandings and nuances that the public have trouble with, and that even other scientists have trouble with, involves level of evidence and uncertainty, which we statisticians think about all the time. And sometimes we take for granted that others don't think this way and understand that. And like one symptom of that is when people use expressions like trust the science, this is what the science says. That implies that science is like some treasure chest of true facts that people are just releasing to the public, saying here it is, this is true, when really that's not science at all. That science is really a set of methods to learn from empirically from data, and then when you go through that process, you accrue evidence, and sometimes you get a level of evidence where you're virtually assured that something is true, and there's a level of consensus. But it's a process to get there. And for many things, we never get that level of certainty. So there's always uncertainty. There's things we don't know. People will sometimes weaponize that uncertainty and suggest that the uncertainty means that the thing that seems to have a high level of evidence isn't true, because you can't disprove the opposite. But I think in many ways, you know, we have to help the public understand the nature of science. So that's what I would suggest to media members is, make sure that you don't slip into the expressions that sort of reinforce this naive view of black and white, and try and communicate to some degree the nuance of science and of uncertainty. And I think that's one way that they can help. And also, I encourage media, you know, members to reach out more to professionals in statistics and epidemiology and other data related fields when the story they're working on seems to have some tricky analytical or interpretive components. The subject matter scientist is good to interview because they understand the subject matter best. But I think sometimes even the subject matter scientist doesn't fully appreciate the nuances to the degree that statisticians and epidemiologists do. So I think it would be good if they reached out to our communities more, and if our community was more active in partnering with them to help convey these things to the public better.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. You can listen to us at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on our program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. Be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.